Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. American society does not yet know what to do with juveniles accused of violent crime. As lawmakers and advocates wrestle with policy, young men and women, both the victims and the accused, muddle through the maze of crime and punishment. A new film from Independent Lens looks at four young men in a screenwriting class behind bars. It's called They Call Us Monsters. It airs on SDPB2 Wednesday, May 24th at 6:30 Central, 5:30 Mountain. Filmmaker Ben Lear joins us now from Los Angeles to talk about the film. Ben Lear, welcome to In the Moment.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm going to take just a minute to gush, and I try not to gush too often, but I'm watching this. I watch a lot of documentaries for this show, and because I like documentaries, this is something I have never seen before in the way it was created and the tenderness with which it was done, the intelligence with which it was done. Tell me, the overall premise of this screenwriting class and how this project sort of, for you, got off the ground.
Yeah, sure. So, well, thank you, first of all. I appreciate that. It all began about 4 years ago. I knew nothing about the juvenile justice system. I was just an aspiring filmmaker. I went in and visited a writing class in a juvenile hall, which actually the same place that the film takes place, which is a facility called The Compound, where LA County keeps all the juveniles that are tried as adults. So these are all the kids separated from the rest because of the crimes that they've committed and the seriousness of the crimes. And I remember going in. I went in with Gabriel Cowan, who teaches the writing program. Neither of us had really, experienced anything like it before. And I just remember having all of my expectations about what, who these kids were and how they would feel, how I would feel, around them. All of that overturned in a moment. My anxiety melted away, and I was having fun and getting to know them, and they were so obviously just teenagers to me in that moment, full of potential. I think Gabriel Cowan felt the same way. He devised this screenwriting class. It was his invention. The idea being he would go in for a number of weeks and write a short film with some of these kids and then go out and film it for them so that they could have some sense of accomplishment behind bars. And that's what we ended up filming for the documentary.
And Gabriel says, what else are they going to do for the next 90 years? So he has this sort of awareness, wry awareness that this could be the beginning of something for them that could also help them grow individually and occupy their time. Because these kids are serious offenders, these kids who were charged with attempted murder. And I said at the beginning, four students, but very quickly, one has already gone into the adult system and you're down to three.
Exactly. Yeah, no, that's the crucial reality is the fact this is not a did they do it type of movie.
Right.
Wrongfully accused movie. I mean, this movie, it's let's assume that they committed these very serious crimes. We're talking, murders, attempted murders in LA, almost exclusively gang related. Let's assume that they did it, but they were teenagers. They're looking at, in some cases, hundreds of years in prison, not a chance in the world at getting out again. What do we do with them? That's the question that the film asks. And it's the same question that the lawmakers are asking around the country as they try to, deal with mass incarceration and
right.
come off of 25 years of tough on crime policies. We're reexamining this as a nation.
Right. You got an incredible amount of access, not only to the students, the offenders, the boys who were locked up, but you spoke with victims, their attorneys. There's video footage of law enforcement confession from one of the boys featured in the film. How did you sort of accomplish that feat of really giving us the full picture by getting so many people to talk to you?
I mean, I think the film is built on its access. I mean, none of this would have been possible. And the first step was really getting the probation department to see, the potential value in telling this story and allowing us to go into the facility. And then the major hurdle was convincing all of these kids' individual adult court judges to allow them to appear on camera. Mm-hmm. And then after that, getting permission to film one of their trials, reaching out to the victim of one of the crimes. That specifically was essential to myself and to my other producer, Sasha Alpert, who came on board midway through and basically said, if we don't tell the victim side of the story, I can't be a part of this. And I totally agree with that. it would have felt completely lopsided and unfair and suspicious, to be honest.
Right.
So that was essential.
Right. And this is a victim who is in a wheelchair because of do I call it a drive-by shooting? Certainly a shooting, an attempted murder in a vehicle. Her entire life has been altered by this 5 minutes in a car.
Yeah. Yeah. And in another case, there was a first-degree murder. You know, someone's life was taken away. And it was important to me to not shy away from those realities. Even though, you know, we're spending most of the time with these young people, you're getting to know them, probably humanizing them, you know, feeling for them in some capacity, but then always being reminded of their crimes and kind of hopefully as an audience living in a state of conflict throughout the film.
As they wait, too, the tension is a lot of the waiting. What will happen to my case while I get thrown back down to juvenile court, while I get moved to adult court? It's not a matter of the consequences coming. It's a matter of when and what they will be.
Yeah, these kids are there while they're living in the compound, they're awaiting their trials. So they're suspended in a limbo of sorts, like it very much literally between childhood and adulthood. They're all coming of age in this facility where their future is completely unknown. Mm-hmm. And as a, you know, imagine being a 16-year-old and facing 80 years in prison. How do you fathom that? How do you fathom that as an adult? I don't know.
Right. Let's talk about the process, the screenwriting class, and Gabriel's work inside. Are these young men capable of, you know, being screenwriters? What does he find out when he first comes in and sits down and says, "We're gonna do some writing"?
Well, that was one of the, I mean, I think that was one of the really rewarding, amazing surprises for me as a filmmaker. Was I had no idea how that class was gonna go.
Right.
You know, they came in the first day and they were nervous and defensive and kind of, you know, posturing a little bit. And slowly they started to open up. But the one thing that was amazing was that Gabe said, "You can write any type of movie you want. You know, you could write a sci-fi movie. You could write a ninja movie." And they all immediately agreed, "Nah, we want to make, we want to tell a story that's true to life. We want to basically tell our story combined." And that quickly settled on loss of innocence as a theme. And then we quickly settled on a kid, you know, a 12-year-old boy, because that happened to be the age at which they all had their loss of innocence experiences. I mean, there were so many commonalities between their stories. It was really natural to come up with this fictional story. And then watching them totally flourish as writers because they felt so much ownership over the story and they felt so much pride in telling it. That they, I mean, the quality of their ideas, they were nuanced, they were thoughtful. It was amazing to watch.
And when you talk about ownership, there's a point where Gabe comes back with a printout of what they've worked on so far, and they start reading it, and they're like, "Nah, you made changes." And, and Gabe's like, "Well, that's what happens when you're a screenwriter. There's, you know, the process," and they're not okay with it. And there's this whole creative, wrestling for creative control. What was that moment sort of like to see them take that ownership, the rather feisty ownership of their own stories?
That moment was huge. I mean, to be honest, my first reaction was, "Oh my God, Gabe, how could you do that?
Right.
How could you change their writing?" I mean, I felt horrible. But then I saw the effect that it had on them, Jared specifically, who prior to that point was goofing off, not doing his homework, not taking it seriously. All of a sudden, this thing's taken out of his hands, which I can only imagine triggered a lot of stuff. I mean, the amount of things that have been taken from these kids, including their childhoods, you know, throughout their lives, to have this project taken away from him. Hmm. It was the moment of the switch flipped on and he took ownership and he said, "You know what? No. I'm taking this back. I'm doing the work. I'm coming in. I'm reading this twice and I'm bringing in notes." And he did. And from that point on, it was a totally different room.
They even go after Gabe's choice of a Latina name. And they're like, "Where did you get that name?" And Gabe says, "I don't know. I Googled Latina names." And they're furious.
Yeah, exactly. I know.
Did he do that on purpose? You know,
was he
thinking that at the moment, like, "Well, let's just, you know, kick him into gear here," or was it just
it was either that or it was the stress of not having a lot of time left and really feeling, you know, the responsibility of getting this thing done and just really thinking, "I'm just filling in blanks that we haven't come up with yet and we can change everything."
Right. Yeah.
I think it was that more than anything.
He treats them as equals creatively, in the sense that you know, he's not going to pull punches with how that process works.
Right. Totally.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's talk about Antonio, and I think that he's the young man who actually we end up seeing released and going on,
yeah,
on the outside. Tell me how that transpires.
Sorry. That was a really unique, incredibly rare situation. I mean, since the filming of the movie, California's passed a law that makes it much easier for juveniles to return back to juvenile court from adult court. But at the time, Antonio's lawyers managed to make a case for him to go back to juvenile court based on the fact that he was barely 14 when he committed his crime and some other circumstances. And so he went from facing 90 years to life to basically doing 9 months camp time in a juvenile camp and getting released. Mm-hmm. So it was crazy for us, especially only filming and following three stories, for one of these kids to have this happen to him and allow us to expand the world of the film and also tell a reentry story was pretty remarkable.
What did you find as you followed him? How painful was that reentry story?
It was hard. It was really hard. It's not a happy story, unfortunately, you know, and I think that's the case for a lot of these young people, you know, when they have suffered extreme trauma growing up and have lived in and out of these facilities and have basically become institutionalized. I mean, Antonio told me at one point, you know, he's getting three meals a day, as a place to sleep. He hasn't been on meth since he got to prison. You know, he's feeling better. He weighs 20 pounds more, all of this stuff. And you hear that from them and then you think, okay, you're getting released. You know, it's not very hopeful. And of course, he returns, you know, right back to his old neighborhood. He's surrounded by all of those old, you know, triggers and elements that led that lifestyle that got him incarcerated. And he's trying at first, you know, he gets into school, he goes to school, he's trying to work, you know, but the opportunities aren't there. The resources aren't there. He gets evicted. And then I think personally, more important than anything else, is that he was dealing with a lot of survivor's guilt, leaving mm-hmm. Juan and Jared behind, all these other kids in the compound that are going away forever. Why him? Why does he get to get out?
Right.
You know, and not feeling worthy of that opportunity is going to lead him to basically act out and prove everybody wrong, which is what happened.
My guest is Ben Lear, and the film on Independent Lens is They Call Us Monsters. It airs on SDPB2 Wednesday, May 24th at 6:30 Central, 5:30 Mountain, again at 11:30 Central, 10:30 Mountain. Ben, let's just close with sort of the therapeutic impact of this work and talk about, I'm sorry, is his name Juan, who ends up making a phone call to Abigail?
Yeah.
Just tell that story we got about a minute left, but tell that story and how that creative process ends up giving him some closure in his personal life.
So in the beginning of the class, we talked to the boys a lot about, you know, darker things and violence and stuff. And at one point, one of the staff members approached me and said, you should talk to them about life, about love, about romance. And the next day I talked to Juan, one of the kids, and he told me about this childhood crush that he's had forever. You know, this girl that he never confessed to her how he felt. And we weaved that into the story. And through the writing process, I think it was really therapeutic for Juan. And ultimately he called her and he told her how he felt. And he had this like really bittersweet conversation with her, all because of, you know, feeling enabled by the story that he was telling. Hmm.
And it's closure because it's really goodbye for him. He's not ever going to see, most likely, the light of day. And when he does, he'll be deported back to El Salvador.
Right.
So
it's
not as if there's a future for these two. Ben Lear, a remarkable film in the way it was crafted as well. I can't emphasize that enough. It's called They Call Us Monsters, Independent Lens, SDPB2, Wednesday, May 24th, 6:30, 5:30 Central. Ben from Los Angeles, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much.